comfortable home, stopping by to see Millie 3 times a week because Russ was too busy to do it himself. It was ironing Russ's shirts, making his oatmeal with raisins the way he liked it, taking his Audi to the car wash so it was gleaming when he returned from his trips. She tosses the postcards in the air and they scatter. She would like to burn them in one of her 6 fireplaces. Nothing would give her greater satisfaction than watching Rosie's declarations of love for Russ curl, blacken, and go up in smoke. Forgiveness, she thinks. She will save the postcards and give them to Maya someday. She picks up the landline and dials, and Huck answers on the first ring.
Hello, he says. Who's calling me from Iowa City?
It's me, Irene says, which she knows is presumptive. They haven't been friends long enough for her to be me.
Hello, you, he says, and she feels better. What's up?
What should Irene tell him first? That she spent all day with the FBI? Or that she found an illicit cache of postcards from his stepdaughter to her husband? Adam leaves a week from Tuesday, she says.
Yep. Huck says.
All right, Irene says. I guess that means I'll be down a week from Monday.
You serious?
Huck says. She hears him exhale, presumably smoke.
Angler cupcake. You serious?
She squeezes her eyes shut. Yes, she says. Ayers.
You're hiding something, Mick says.
It's one of their rare nights off together, and they're having dinner at the bar at Ocean 362, where they can watch the sunset. Ayers spent the afternoon on Salomon Bay by herself. Mick asked to come along, but Ayers said she wanted to be alone. It was important, this time around, to preserve her me time. I want to lie in the sun and think about Rosie, she said.
You can think about Rosie with me right next to you, Mick said. You can even talk about Rosie. I'll listen.
It's not the same, Ayers said. You'll distract me. What she didn't tell Mick, couldn't tell him, was that she needed time to read Rosie's journals. She had made it from the year 2000, Rosie at age 17, all the way through her tumultuous relationship with Oscar, to the weekend in 2006 when she met Russ. Ayers was just getting to the good stuff, the important stuff, but it was tricky, finding blocks of time to read. If you're suspicious, Ayers says now, it's probably because of your own guilty conscience. She digs into the walnut-crusted Roquefort cheesecake.
What?
He says. Don't act offended, Ayers says. She lowers her voice because the bartender, Alex, is a friend of theirs, and she doesn't want him to hear their squabbling. We agreed we wouldn't dance around the topic of your infidelity. We agreed you would own it, and that I was free to bring it up at any time.
Within reason. We said within reason.
You're accusing me of hiding something, Ayers says. Meanwhile, you haven't even fired Bridget.
I can't fire her just because we broke up. Mick says, that's against the law.
He pulls his phone out because the sun is going down, and one of Mick's passions is photographing the sunset every night, then posting it on Instagram as #sunset, #sunsetpics, #sunsetlover. Ayers has forgotten how this annoys her. She enjoys a good sunset as much as the next person, but she finds pictures of the sunset #overdone. You can fire her because she's a terrible server, Ayers says. She's the worst server I've ever seen.
You're biased.
Ayers carefully constructs a bite, a slice of toasted baguette smeared with the Roquefort, topped with the accompanying shallot and garlic confit. How do you think I feel knowing that she's right there under your nose every single night? The answer is not great. But do I complain? Do I sniff your clothes or show up at the restaurant unannounced? No. Do I accuse you of hiding something? I do not.
You're right,
Mick says. He's distracted by his sunset posting.
I'm sorry.
Ayers lets the topic drop because guess what? She is hiding something. She's obsessed with Rosie's journals,
and she isn't using that word cavalierly like the rest of the world now does. I'm obsessed with AOC's lipstick, or Mango with Chili Salt, or Seven Rings by Ariana Grande. If Ayers didn't have two jobs and a boyfriend, she would lock herself in a room and binge on the journals until she had read the whole story. But there is pleasure to be had in pacing herself. Read, then process. Of course, it's more difficult to hold back now that Russ has entered the picture. Ayers and Mick finish dinner and decide to end the evening by going to La Tapa for a nightcap. To an outsider, it might seem pathetic that Ayers can't stay away from her place of employment on her night off, but the fact is, La Tapa is her home, and her co-workers are her family. Skip and Tilda finally hooked up. They've been circling each other since October, and Tilda told Ayers that for 3 days straight, they did nothing but drink Schramsberg, eat mango with chili salt, and have wild sex. But on the fourth day, Tilda woke up at Skip's place and wondered what the hell she was doing there. "It was like the fever broke," Tilda whispered to Ayers as they polished glasses before service. "I'm over him. In fact, looking at him makes me feel kind of sick." Human nature being what it is, when Tilda's enthusiasm cooled, Skip's grew more intense, and Tilda confided to Ayers, yes, somehow Ayers and Tilda were becoming confidants, that Skip followed her home to her parents' villa one night after work. Tilda's parents are quite wealthy and have a home in Peter Bay. Tilda doesn't have to work at La Tapa, but she's determined not to play the role of entitled rich kid, so she hammers out 4 shifts a week and also volunteers at the animal care center, walking rescue dogs. The more Ayers learns about Tilda's life outside of work, the harder it is not to admire and even like her. When Tilda explained to Skip in her parents' driveway, she was not about to invite Skip in, that she thought maybe they had gotten too close too quickly, Skip had started to cry. Now, apparently, he's venting his anger at the restaurant during service. He's been acting erratically with the customers. And sure enough, after Ayers and Mick claim 2 seats at the bar and order Ayers' favorite sipping tequila, Ayers overhears Skip describing a bottle of Malbec for the couple sitting a few stools away like this. "This wine is a personal favorite of mine," Skip says. "It has hints of hashish, old piñata candy, and the tears of cloistered nuns." "What?" the woman says. "No, thank you." Ayers waves Skip over. "You okay?" "Great, Ayers, yeah," Skip says, scowling. "Seriously, never better." He looks over Ayers' shoulder and his expression changes. "Hey, man, how you doing? Good to see you. I'm sorry, bud, I've forgotten your name." "Cash," a voice says. Ayers whips around. "Cash," she says. She hops off her stool. It's Cash Steele, here at La Tapa. Ayers remembers too late that she's angry with him. She finds that she's happy, really happy to see him. She inadvertently checks behind him to see if maybe Baker followed him in. No, but Ayers finds her heart bouncing around at the prospect of his being here. "Hey, Ayers," Cash says. He offers Skip a hand across the bar. "Good to see you, man. Just got in on the ferry. I'm starving. Can I get an order of mussels and the bread with 3 sauces? "You got it, Cash," Skip says. Cash eyes the stool next to Ayers. "This taken?" Mick clears his throat. Ayers says, "No, no, sit, please. Cash, this is Mick, and Mick, this is Cash Steele." Mick raises his tequila and slams back the whole thing. Cash nods in response. "So, what are you doing here?" Ayers asks. "I thought you guys went back to your lives in America." Which is how it always happens, she thinks, which is why she doesn't date tourists.
"My life in America kind of fell apart," Cash says, "so that text you sent me was pure serendipity."
On the other side of Ayers, Mick sounds like he's choking. Ayers watches Skip set a glass of water in front of him. "Text?" Ayers says,
though she knows exactly what Cash is talking about.
About the job on Treasure Island, Cash says. Have you filled it?
No, Ayers says. We haven't. We're pretty desperate, actually. Wade leaves in another week.
Cash slaps some paperwork down on the bar. I can fast-track my life-saving certification, he says. I should be good to go in another week.
Seriously? Ayers says. You want the job on Treasure Island?
I'd love it, Cash says.
Ayers hears Mick muttering on the other side of her. She would be lying if she said she wasn't taking some satisfaction in his discomfort. She must be angrier at him than she realized. Cash! Tilda swoops in and throws her arms around Cash's neck, then gives him a juicy kiss on the cheek.
Hey, Tilda, Cash says.
Across the bar, Skip holds Cash's order of bread with three sauces. He glares at Tilda and Cash, then comes just short of slamming the plate down.
I thought you were in Colorado, Tilda says. I've been trying to figure out how to tell my parents that I'm taking a trip to Breckenridge to ski with you.
No Breck for the foreseeable future, Cash says. I'm moving down here, and hopefully working on Treasure Island with Ayers.
Working on Treasure Island with Ayers, Mick mimics under his breath. Moving down here? Tilda says. That's hot. Skip huffs.
Hot, he says. Get back to work, Tilda.
Tilda appears unfazed. Call me later, she says to Cash. She sashays off to give the table 8 dessert menus. Ayers says, I didn't realize you knew Tilda.
You sound jealous. Mick murmurs, how about you let Loverboy eat his bread and we get out of here? She gave me a ride home when I was here the last time, Cash says. She's cool.
She's taken, Skip says. He's holding Cash's muscles and looks like he might dump them over Cash's head. She's not taken, Ayers says. She waves Skip away. Get back to work yourself.
You're not my boss, Skip says.
Mick stands up.
I'm going home. Are you coming?
Ayers looks from Cash to Mick. It's a standoff, she realizes. To Cash, she says, Hey, I'm picking up Maya tomorrow morning and we're hiking from Lester Bay to Brown Bay. Then swimming after. Do you want to join us?
Do you think Maya would mind?
Cash asks. Are you kidding me? She'll love it.
I'm in, Cash says. I have Winnie with me. She's tied up outside.
Winnie, Ayers says. This is so great. I'll text you in the morning. How are you getting to the villa? I mean, we can wait until you're finished and give you a ride.
No, we can't, Mick says. We have to get home. I have work in the morning.
At 4 o'clock, Ayers says. Chill.
Don't tell me to chill, Mick says. Please.
No problem, Cash says.
I'll see if Tilda can give me a ride home. If not, I'll take a taxi.
Skip leans across the bar.
How are those muscles? He asks aggressively.
I'll see you tomorrow, Ayers says. Welcome back. Ayers weaves her way out of the restaurant. Mick is already on the sidewalk, lighting a cigarette. Ayers stops to rub Winnie's head. She seems to recognize Ayers. Her tail is wagging like crazy. Mick takes a deep drag of his cigarette, then exhales.
I guess I'm confused. That's Banker's brother, right?
Cash, right.
And you guys are buddy-buddy as well?
Mick, stop.
You texted him,
Mick says.
You told him about the opening on Treasure Island.
That was a Hail Mary, Ayers says. He came out on Treasure Island a few weeks ago. He was good with the guests.
The plot thickens, Mick says. Why am I just hearing about this?
Ayers shrugs. Why would I have told you? We were broken up. Angry exhale of smoke. You know we need to hire someone who already has a place to live, Ayers says, like Cash. And I think he'd be excellent on the boat. Not okay, not good, excellent. He likes people. He's a ski instructor.
Did you not hear him say his life fell apart?
Mick says.
Doesn't that send up a red flag?
His father died, Mick. He found out his father had this whole other life. That's enough to throw anyone into a tailspin.
Yeah, but wouldn't you think he'd want to stay as far away from here as possible?
Ayers inhales the night air. There's guitar music floating down from the quiet mon. Across the street, the lights twinkle at Extra Virgin Bistro. I think he came down here and fell in love with the place, she says, just like I did, just like you did.
As long as he didn't fall in love with you, Mick says. But who are we kidding? Of course he did. There isn't a woman in Colorado or anywhere else that's as beautiful and sexy and cool as you.
Ayers climbs into Mick's blue Jeep. She's still bothered by the memory of Bridget sitting in this seat. Honestly, I barely know him.
And yet you invited him hiking with you and Maya tomorrow. You didn't invite me. You invited money.
Cash, Ayers says, trying not to smile. Mick is good with nicknames, and it'll be hard for her now not to think of Baker and Cash as banker and money. You don't like hiking. And I'll point out that Cash is Maya's brother.
Half-brother.
Whatever. He and Baker are Maya's only blood relatives, aside from whoever is left on Rosie's father's side.
I don't want you hiking with him.
You don't have any say.
But we're in a relationship, Mick says.
We're dating. You don't own me. I'm sorry that you don't like it. I don't like it that Bridget still works for you. I didn't like driving down to the beach bar at 3 o'clock in the morning and seeing you.
Stop, Mick says.
I'm going hiking with Cash and Maya, Ayers says, and Winnie.
Great, Mick says. You're cheating on Gordon as well.
Just drive, Ayers says. She leans back in the seat, marveling at the unexpected turn the night has taken and how buoyant she now feels. Mick is jealous, but Ayers doesn't care. Cash is here, and tomorrow, Ayers will ask him about Baker. Cash. His mother called to tell him about her visit from the FBI, so Cash isn't surprised when the taxi turns onto his father's road and he sees a dark SUV parked in one of the dummy driveways. They're watching the house. Well, he can't blame them. It's been nearly 3 weeks since he left. The villa seems basically the same, although Cash can tell things have been gone through. The bed in the guest room he used last time has been hastily made, and all of the drawers in the adjacent bath are ajar. Cash does a quick check of the house, and this seems to be the case throughout. Irene said they found nothing at the house in Iowa City, and Cash imagines the same is true here. There was very little of a personal nature in this house to begin with. When they arrived the first time, reeling from the news of Russ's death, it seemed more like a hotel than someone's house. It feels good, though, to have the place to himself. It feels better than good. It feels luxurious. Cash stands out on the deck bare-chested, while Winnie goes nuts sniffing everything and chasing after geckos. Cash gazes down the lush, leafy hill over the moon-spangled water. He's king of the castle. He wants to howl. He wants to sing. The villa is his. His exultation is tied to seeing Ayers. He wondered if he'd built her up in his mind, but when he saw her from behind, her curly blonde hair hanging loose and crazy down her back, and the silhouette of her body in that halter top and white jeans, he felt like he was being swallowed up. She had been so happy to see him, happier than he would have predicted, and she had seemed nearly jealous when Tilda came over to give Cash a hug. The interaction had been great, 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 everything Cash could have dreamed of. Today was the first day of the rest of his life, Cash thinks. It's a tired phrase, and yet so true, so true. He has never been more certain of anything. His life began today. He swung down here on a slender filament of hope that a potential job on Treasure Island offered, and now it looks like it will all work out. He wants to beat his chest. He has escaped the doom of a lonely winter in Iowa City, shoveling snow and bumping into ex-girlfriends at the grocery store. Tomorrow he has plans with Ayers and Maya, and Monday he starts his life-saving course, which Irene has given him more than enough money to pay for.
"I'm so happy," Cash cries out.
He wonders if the FBI has bugged the house. Well, if they have, they are going to hear the 29-year-old son of Russell Steele talking to himself. And maybe it will seem strange or even cruel that Cash is so jubilant only a few short weeks after his father died. Cash misses his father. He's mourning his father, and he's angry and resentful and disappointed in his father. But all of that feels like a pot Cash can pull off the stove for now. His excitement about this island and this girl and this sense of freedom and opportunity win out.
"It's going to be epic," Cash says.
Winnie barks and comes trotting over. She noses around Cash's legs, and he bends to rub her soft butterscotch head. "Right, Winnie? Right?" The next morning, Cash winds his way down the hill in one of his father's gray jeeps, stops at the black SUV, and rolls down his window.
"I'm Cash Steele," he says, "Russell Steele's son."
The man sitting in the front seat, shaved head, blonde Hulk Hogan mustache, flexes one of his enormous biceps as he brings a cup of coffee to his lips.
"I know," he says.
Cash waits a second, thinking maybe there will be more, but the guy looks down into his lap. He's reading the paper. Cash is the one with questions. Who is this guy? Why is he watching the house? But Cash is certain he'll be stonewalled and he doesn't want to be late, so he carries on. He meets Ayers and Maya in the parking area on Lester Bay Road. In Cash's backpack are 3 towels, 9 bottles of water, and 3 sandwiches from the North Shore Deli. He's wearing trunks under his cargo shorts, his Social Distortion t-shirt, and his lightweight hiking boots. Both girls are standing next to Ayers' green truck, tying bandanas around their foreheads.
"Hey,"
Cash says as he climbs out of the Jeep. Winnie heads straight for Maya, who crouches down to pet her. Winnie is an excellent ambassador. As always, she smooths over a potentially awkward situation. Cash follows, tentatively offering Maya a fist bump. Ayers said that Maya would be cool with Cash joining them, but will she? Cash knows nothing about the psyches of 12-year-old girls.
"Hey, bro,"
Maya says. She bumps knuckles with him, then grins.
"You came back, and Ayers tells me you're going to work on Treasure Island."
"That's the plan," he says.
He glances quickly at Ayers in her white tank and light blue Lululemon running shorts. He can see the outline of a bikini underneath.
"Ayers' boyfriend, Mick, is really jealous,"
Maya says.
"Maya," Ayers says, "hush."
"What?"
Maya says.
"He is. He's even jealous we're taking this hike."
"Well, he doesn't need to be jealous," Cash says. "Ayers and I are just friends."
"That's what I told him," Ayers says.
She drops her blue aviators down over her eyes.
"Are you sure you don't mind carrying the pack? It's gotta be heavy."
"Please," Cash says. "I hike at 8,000-9,000 feet with a pack that's 3 times this weight."
"Ayers doesn't like hiking," Maya says, "but she's my parent now, so she has to do enriching things with me."
"Mangrove snorkeling is enriching," Ayers says. She looks up at the brilliant blue sky.
"And a far more appropriate activity than hiking on an 80-degree day."
"Next week,"
Maya says. She strides toward the trailhead.
"Come on, Winnie, let's go."
The Johnny Horn Trail has 5 spurs, Maya explains. The first spur, a flat, sandy walking path, leads to a narrow beach hugging a bay that has a rugged island 100 yards offshore.
"Water Lemon Key," Ayers says. "Best snorkeling on St. John."
"How about I stay here and you guys keep going?"
"We've only been hiking 30 seconds,
Maya says. She turns to Cash.
"See what I have to deal with?"
The second spur takes them up a steep, rocky incline that requires a fair amount of scrambling and careful foot placement before it levels out when they reach stone ruins. "This is the guardhouse," Maya tells them, "built in the 1840s, back when slavery had been abolished in the British Virgin Islands across the Sir Francis Drake Channel, but was still legal on St. John. There were 16 soldiers stationed here, Maya says, and their job was to keep watch for runaway slaves.
Cash is impressed. You have quite the body of knowledge, he says. How did you learn all this?
My mom, Maya says. She knew everything about the Virgin Islands.
Cash nods as the peculiarity of what he's doing hits him. He's hiking with a half-sister he never knew he had. Maya bows her head and is quiet, and Ayers places a hand on the back of her neck and draws her in. They're thinking about Rosie. Cash can feel how much they miss her. A 12-year-old girl lost her mother, lost both of her parents, and yet here she is, bravely soldiering on with her mother's best friend and a strange man she has gamely decided to accept as bro.
Did your mom like to hike? Cash asks.
No, Maya says, and she and Ayers laugh. She was more like Ayers. She preferred the beach. But, I mean, she brought me up here a few times because she wanted me to experience the place we lived.
I wish I'd been able to meet your mom, Cash says honestly.
More than once over the past couple of weeks, Cash has imagined this whole thing unfolding differently. What if, at some point, Russ had just come clean about his life, said that business had taken him to the Caribbean and he'd met a woman and fallen in love? Cash and Baker would have been furious at first, incredulous, resentful on Irene's behalf. They probably would have refused to speak to Russ for a while. But eventually, Cash suspects, they would have come to terms with the situation and flown down to visit Russ here. They could have met Rosie. It might have taken time, but they could have accepted her as part of the family. Cash shakes his head. That is a trail spur that never was. There's no use dwelling on it.
Shall we go?
Ayers asks.
Get this over with?
After the guardhouse, they begin to hit their stride. There's not much canopy cover, but even so, Cash finds himself slowing down so he can enjoy just being. His breathing steadies. He reminds himself he doesn't need to be anywhere. He has nothing else to do today. Ayers is here. Maya is here. Ayers is right. It's hot, but just then the sun disappears behind a cloud, so there's a brief respite. Maya not only knows history, she is also quite the naturalist. She points out a ganip tree. In the summer, it produces a fruit similar to a lime. Cash has never heard of it.
In the summer, I eat elk jerky, Cash says.
Maya shoots him a look. I'm a vegetarian, she says.
You are? Cash says. Ayers told me to get you a pastrami melt.
I make an exception for pastrami, Maya says, and Candy's barbecue.
Maya points out wild tamarind, cassia trees, and something called catch and keep, which is a cute name for a nefarious pricker bush. They eventually reach a scenic overlook where each of them, Winnie included, sucks down a bottle of water. Maya points across the way to Yost Van Dyke and Tortola. After the lookout, the trail heads downhill and it's fully shaded. Everyone seems a little happier.
So I guess I'll address the elephant in the room, Maya says. How's your brother?
Cash isn't sure he's heard right.
Is Baker an elephant?
I don't know, Ayers. Is Baker an elephant?
Maya says.
Stop being precocious for 1 minute, please, Ayers says.
She turns to Cash, and he can see the hopeful expectation in her face, even with her sunglasses on.
How is Baker? He went back to Houston, I take it? I haven't heard from him.
Cash can't look at her. He concentrates on walking, left foot, then right, steady in his boots, moving down the dirt trail over rocks and around the tentacles of catch and keep. Ayers likes Baker. She's hung up on him. Cash can hear it in her voice. He can't believe it. He'd met Mick the night before, and Mick is who she's with now. But Cash isn't intimidated by Mick. Mick is ridiculous, a clown who cheated on Ayers once and who would most certainly do it again.
I haven't heard from him since our grandmother died a few days after we all got home, Cash says.
Millie? Maya says.
The one I look like?
Yes, Cash says. He chastises himself for being insensitive. Millie was Maya's grandmother, too. How weird is that? I'm sorry. I should have broken the news in a different way. She was really old, 99. They are all silent for a moment. Then Ayers says,
So you don't know if Baker is pursuing a divorce, or...
No idea, Cash says, cutting her off. If you're curious about Baker, just call him. You have his number, right?
Right, Ayers says.
Uh-oh, Maya says. Sounds like somebody needs lunch.
When they reach Brown Bay, Maya shows them a little cemetery.
These are the graves of islanders from long ago,
Maya says, which is obvious, as the modest headstones are so old and weathered they're barely legible.
But I kind of wish my mom had been buried here. Look at this view, and it's so peaceful and shady under these trees.
She would have liked it here, Ayers says. Where? Cash starts. He has no idea where Rosie is buried.
She's with my grandma in the cemetery in Cruz Bay, Maya says. Or that's where her body is. Her spirit is wherever spirits go when people die.
They march single file onto a ribbon of white sand beach. It's completely deserted, and the water is a clear, placid turquoise. Cash can't recall ever seeing such inviting water. He shucks off the backpack and strips out of his shirt and shorts. Winnie is already splashing in, barking with joy and, probably, relief. Cash follows, and soon he's floating on his back, staring up into the cloudless sky. He hears Maya and Ayers get into the water as well. Cash tries to readjust his frame of mind. He's not going to let his brother ruin a perfectly good day when he's 1,000 miles away in Houston. Cash likes Ayers. Ayers likes Baker. It's a classic like triangle. But Cash has the advantage because Cash is here and Baker isn't. Cash has a further advantage because he will soon be working with Ayers. After spending some time with him, Ayers will realize that he's the superior steel brother. She'll fall in love. He will somehow make her fall in love. After swimming, he joins Ayers and Maya, who are drying off on a flat rock. Picnic rock, Maya calls it. Cash passes out the sandwiches and gives Winnie the biscuits he brought. Maya slips Winnie some of her pastrami, which makes her Winnie's new best friend. The silence is companionable, Cash thinks, or maybe it's awkward. He can't tell. It's true that, among the three of them, there are a number of taboo subjects. How's Huck? Cash asks.
Grouchy, Maya says.
Yeah?
Part of it is that I've started going to town with my friends and he doesn't like it.
I don't like it either,
Ayers says.
We're just hanging out, Maya says.
Who's we? Ayers and Cash say at the same time. They exchange a look, and for a second, Cash feels like he and Ayers are Maya's parents instead of her half-brother and sort of aunt.
Me and Joan,
Maya says.
And?
Ayers says.
And Colton Seeley and Bright Whitaker,
Maya says. She licks some mustard off her thumb.
Joan has a crush on Colton.
And you have a crush on Bright?
Ayers asks.
No,
Maya says.
Bright isn't my type. Plus, he has a crush on Posey Alvarez.
Do I know Posey?
She goes to Antilles,
Maya says. She's friends with a kid named Shane who's a year ahead of us.
I'm going to take a wild stab in the dark here,
Ayers says. You have a crush on Shane. Maya shrugs.
I might.
I can't believe it,
Ayers says.
Your first crush. I have to meet this kid.
I'm going to come find you guys in town one day before work, and Cash, you have to come with me. This is your little sister. You need to protect her. You need to be a lieutenant in the cause.
Cash opens his mouth, but he's unsure of what to say. Your little sister. You need to protect her. The FBI are staking out the house. Russ was conducting illegal business. He likely got Rosie killed. Do Ayers and Maya know this? If they don't know and they find out, will they hate Cash?
Isn't it better to prepare for this eventuality and remain aloof? Cash focuses on Ayers for a second. She's sitting on Picnic Rock, wearing a white bikini and a towel around her waist. Her blonde hair is drying in the sun. She takes a bite of her Cuban sandwich, waiting for him to answer. They won't hate him, he realizes. They know his heart is pure. That he's as bewildered as they are, maybe more so. He's a good guy. He doesn't know a thing about having a little sister. Both the phrase and the notion are completely foreign to him, but he wants to learn. He wants some good to come out of the choices Russ made. Their relationship, his and Maya's, can be part of that good. I would certainly like to meet Shane before this goes any further, he says. Maya rolls her eyes theatrically, and although Cash knows exactly nothing about 12-year-old girls, he can tell that beneath the surface of her exasperation, she's grateful. Her mother is gone, but she's not alone. She has heirs, and now she has Cash, and they're here to pay attention. They're here to care about her. Just please, please don't tell Huck, Maya says. You have my word, Ayers says. And mine, Cash says. So I told my secret, Maya says. Now it's your turn. Cash, who do you have a crush on? Okay, Cash says, standing up. Time to head back. He whistles for Winnie, who is down the beach, chasing stray chickens. He has a crush on Ayers, more than a crush. When they get back to the parking lot, it's difficult to say goodbye. Ayers has to work at La Tapa that night and on Treasure Island the next day, and Maya is going fishing with Huck. Then, next week, Maya has school and Cash starts his life-saving classes. He can begin crewing on Treasure Island a week from Sunday. Wade will still be around to train him. A week from Sunday feels awfully far away. Maybe you and I can hike again sometime, Maya says. I'll take you to the Esperance Trail. There's a baobab tree. It's a date, he says. He peers over Maya's head at Ayers. Thanks for inviting me along today. Of course, Ayers says. She and Maya hop in the little green truck and wave. See you later. Cash and Winnie watch them drive away. There's no reason to feel down, and yet he does. He drives back to the villa, knowing he can crack a beer and spend what remains of the afternoon by the pool, and then he should take a trip to the grocery store because he can't eat at La Tapa every night, or he'll quickly burn through the money Irene gave him. He passes the black SUV in the dummy driveway. Different guy, dark complected. Cash waves. When he gets up to the house, he hears voices splashing. Someone is in the pool. Whoa. Cash's first crazy thought is that it's FBI agent number one. His second thought is that the house has been rented and Paulette forgot to tell Irene, or maybe she thought it wouldn't matter since they'd gone back to the States. That must be it. What is Cash going to do? He doesn't have money for a hotel and his life-saving class starts Monday. He sends Winnie up the stairs ahead of him. Paulette will have to come up with a solution. Find these people another house. Cash is nearly at the top step, prepping himself for an uncomfortable confrontation, when he hears a young voice say, Winnie, Uncle Cash. It's Floyd, bobbing in the pool, and Baker, sitting on the edge in just his bathing trunks. Hey, Baker says. What? Cash shakes his head. Winnie's tail is going nuts. She barks. What are you doing here?
We're moving here, Floyd announces. To live.
Huck. Agent Colette Vasco is a serious woman, though not unkind. She has a niece Maya's age, her sister's daughter, and they're very close. Agent Vasco knows that being 12 isn't easy, and she understands how difficult things must be for Maya right now with the sudden loss of her mother. She agrees to come get the money while Maya is at school. I'm sorry to say I have to bring a search team, including a drug dog, but if all goes according to plan, Maya will never know we've been there. Huck is grateful.
A team of four show up, along with a German shepherd named Comanche. Comanche does a quick, frenetic tour of the house, although he's in and out of Huck's room in a matter of seconds, which makes Huck wonder if maybe it does smell like rotting fish. Comanche is tied up in the shade outside while the team comes in to retrieve the money from under Huck's bed. Then they systematically search the rest of Huck's house. Huck would be worried about them invading Maya's room, but it looks like it's already been ransacked. There are clothes everywhere. Supplies for Maya's bath bomb business are spread across her desk, and hair products and makeup cover the surface of the dresser. There's also a fair amount of trash, wrappers from Clif Bars, half-full cans of LaCroix coconut seltzer.
"Maybe you could clean up while you're in there," Huck jokes.
The FBI agents don't so much as crack a smile. They aren't humans, they're robots, Huck thinks. Robots on a mission. Fine, Huck will leave them to it. He peers into Rosie's room. Vasco herself is on her knees, pawing through the dresser drawers. Then he goes into the kitchen, does a shot of Flor de Caña, and heads out to the deck, where he smokes three cigarettes in quick succession and keeps an eye on the southern waters for the Mississippi. Adam is taking the charter by himself today. Huck called and told him that something came up and he couldn't get away. Agent Vasco lets Huck know that they haven't found anything else of interest. They are taking the cash, and Vasco asks for the numbers of Rosie's savings and checking accounts. "I realize how difficult it must have been to call us about that money," Agent Vasco says. She lays a hand on Huck's arm. Her nails are polished shell pink, and she wears no wedding ring. Huck checks out of habit. Agent Vasco is an attractive woman, a redhead like Huck, and she has a salty, sweet aspect that reminds Huck of his ex-wife, Kimberly. And, for that matter, Leanne. Huck puts Agent Vasco at about 35, still young enough to want children, which is too young for Huck. He's encouraged that he's even thinking this way. It's taking his mind off Irene. When he next talks to Irene, he'll tell her how attractive Agent Vasco is. Maybe she'll get jealous.
"That wasn't money I earned, and I doubt it was money Rosie earned," Huck says.
He hands over the statements from Rosie's bank accounts.
"If Rosie is guilty by association of something, well, it's my job to make sure it doesn't affect Maya in any way."
"I understand," Agent Vasco says. "I was really hoping I might find something of a more personal nature in Rosie's room. Letters or a diary?"
"Diary?" Huck thinks.
Rosie kept a diary when she was younger. She used to threaten Leanne with it, saying that future generations would someday learn what a mean witch Leanne was, how harsh and unfair she was to her only child. Huck has no idea if Rosie kept up her diary writing into her adult years. Because she worked nights at La Tapa, most of her downtime was during the day when Huck was at work and Maya at school. Letters? Well, there might be letters from Russell Steele if this were 1819 or even 1989, but nowadays people didn't write letters. They wrote to each other on their phones.
"I'm sure Rosie had her phone with her."
"Yes," Agent Vasco says. "We've subpoenaed the records." Subpoenaed sounds serious, but of course, Rosie had a huge amount of cash stuffed into a drawer.
"If you don't mind my asking, what kind of crimes are you investigating?"
Huck is thinking drugs, obviously. It's the Caribbean. "I'm not at liberty to say. Also, we aren't really sure what we're dealing with here." Agent Vasco offers Huck a tight smile. "If we have any further questions, I'll be in touch."
"That's it?" Huck says. "You're leaving me?"
"Yes," Agent Vasco says. "You should be happy." She gathers the goons and they follow her out to the car with two black duffel bags filled with the money.
"Easy come, easy go," Huck thinks.
Agent Vasco and company drive down Jacob's Ladder's series of switchbacks. Huck spies the car once, twice, three times, then they disappear. At nearly the same moment, Huck sees the Mississippi gliding across Rendezvous Bay. Today's charter was a couple of state troopers from Alaska. Apparently, these two are famous. They're featured on some reality TV show, which Huck has a difficult time fathoming. Huck has less than no interest in celebrities. What makes him regret missing today is that these gentlemen really wanted to fish. Huck nearly calls Adam to tell him to turn around and pick him up at the West End dock, but that's impractical, a waste of time and gas. It's only 10 o'clock, and Huck doesn't have to get Maya until 3. He could read his book. He still hasn't finished the Connolly, and he supposes he could go to the beach. He hasn't been in a long time. Whenever Maya wanted to go, Rosie would take her. Leanne used to love sitting on Gibney, and Huck loved Leanne, so he would join her there. Though left to his own devices, he would go to Little Lamshore, far, far away from the crowded North Shore. Should Huck pack up a fish sandwich and drive out to Little Lamshore? Maybe live really large and stop at the tourist trap for a lobster roll on the way? It's novel enough to be intriguing, but then Huck thinks about one of Agent Vasco's comments. We aren't really sure what we're dealing with here. Huck isn't sure what they're dealing with either, but he does know one thing. He was relieved when the dog didn't go pawing at the floorboards and they didn't discover blocks of cocaine or heroin to go along with all that money. Someone on this island must know more than Huck does. The coconut telegraph is real. Huck picks up his phone and calls Rupert. Because Rupert doesn't like to leave Coral Bay, he and Huck meet at Skinny Legs. It turns out it's as good a place as any to have a quiet conversation in the middle of a gorgeous sunny day. Skinny Legs is the quintessential Caribbean bar. It's tucked into a grove of shade trees a few hundred feet from the lip of Coral Bay. The bar itself looks like a lean-to built by Robinson Crusoe after a few rum punches. It's open to the air on one side and features picnic tables thick with paint and a little stage for live music from happy hour until last call. There's an adjacent gift shop that sells souvenirs celebrating all things Skinny Legs. Huck has never set foot in it. In Huck's opinion, Skinny Legs' only fault is that it's gotten so famous. The best way to ruin a place is to make it popular. One of the things that keeps Skinny Legs authentic is that characters like Rupert still hang out here. Rupert is the prince of the establishment, if you can call a 60-something-year-old man a prince. He's in his usual spot, corner stool on the right-hand side. He has a Bud Light in front of him. Huck checks the time, 11:15. He still has more than 3 hours before he has to pick up Maya from school, and for this conversation, he probably needs something stronger than an iced tea. He flags down Heidi, the bartender.
Painkiller, please, Huck says.
Rupert chuckles.
That's a woman's drink. I'm not allowed to say things like that in my house, Huck says. Don't you know any better?
He takes a stool and rubs the top of Rupert's bald brown head. They fall into their usual pattern of conversation, which is distinguished by long pauses and subsequent non sequiturs. Rupert doesn't like to be rushed. He's retired now and has earned the right to mull things over, and if his mind wanders in the process, oh well. Rupert has lived on St. John his entire life. His family goes back generations, and Huck teases him by saying that Rupert's ancestors invented the concept of island time, but Rupert is the one who perfected it. Huck drinks one painkiller and waves to Heidi for another before Rupert finishes summarizing his list of physical ailments. His back has been giving him trouble. His right toe throbs in the rain. He can't sleep more than 3 hours without having to get up to take a piss. Then it's Huck's turn to talk about how the fish are running. Better since the new year, he says, meaning since Rosie died, meaning since Irene set foot on his boat and into his life.
Good to hear it, Rupert says. And how's Maya?
Huck tells Rupert about taking Maya to town with her friends and how that bothers him. Rupert laughs.
It's a goddamned island, Huck. How much trouble can she get in? All the West Indian ladies who grew up with your wife have eyes in the backs of their heads. If Maya takes so much as a puff of a cigarette, you'll hear the crowing all the way up on Jacob's ladder.
Huck shakes his head. They don't smoke anymore, Rupert. They vape. It's electronic. Thing looks like a pen. They put a pod in it.
Don't tell me, Rupert says. I don't want to know. It's all happening so fast. And I don't like the timing, her getting so independent right after her mother dies.
This is when Maya would be most vulnerable to vaping and drinking and, Huck can barely let himself think it, sex. He has to find a way to make sure she grows up responsibly. Honestly, he could use some help. They're quiet a few minutes. The song in the background is Warren Zevon's Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
Huck isn't sure Rupert is listening to the music, but it feels like a natural segue.
So I had a visit this morning, Huck says, from the FBI.
Huck can sense his friend's invisible antennae rising.
That's why I called you, actually, Huck says, to see if you know something I don't.
Funny you should ask, Rupert says, because I heard federal officers paid a visit to the Welcome to Paradise real estate office.
Really?
Huck says.
Paulette Vickers?
Paulette and Doug Vickers and the little boy are gone, Rupert says.
Rumor has it they left last night on the car barge.
Left as in left, Rupert says. Left as in left. Paulette and Douglas Vickers, who owned Welcome to Paradise Real Estate, pulled their young son, Windsor, out of school and packed what they needed into Doug's pickup and left 12 hours before the FBI showed up. That was the story Rupert heard from Sadie, one of his many girlfriends, and Sadie's gossip was generally known to be reliable. On his way home, Huck drives past the office. And sure enough, there's the black SUV parked out front, its presence as ominous as a hearse. The question that bothers Huck is this. How did Paulette and Douglas Vickers know that the FBI were coming? Did they find out Huck had contacted Agent Vasco? Was Huck's phone compromised? Was there a bug somewhere in his house? If so, would the FBI have found it this morning in their search? Huck lights a cigarette. He needs to get a grip. This is the stuff of movies and Connolly novels. This is not daily life in the Virgin Islands. At 3 o'clock, he's waiting out in front of the Gift Hill School when Maya emerges with her cronies Joni, Colton, and Bright.
Here we go again, Huck thinks.
Maya studies his expression.
You okay, Gramps? You in a bad mood again?
He meant what he told Agent Vasco. He is determined to keep whatever Rosie was involved with away from Maya. She's a 12-year-old girl who wants to hang out with her friends. It's a goddamned island. She's safe here. But really, he could use some help.
I'm fine, he says.
He won't smile because then Maya will know there's something wrong, so he adopts the air of a weary chauffeur.
You guys can all hop in.
Baker. He knows he shouldn't be surprised that his brother came back down to St. John and, apparently, plans to make it his permanent home, sponging off Irene, but he is. He tells Cash as much, though instead of using the word sponging, he calls it taking full advantage of Mom's generosity. It's marginally kinder. After all, Floyd is listening.
I'm not taking advantage any more than you are,
Cash says, with what Baker can only assume is a phony smile.
And I found a job.
So soon? Baker says.
Where? First mate on Treasure Island, Cash says.
First mate on Treasure Island? It takes Baker a second, but he puts it together. Treasure Island is the boat that Ayers works on.
You have got to be.
He swallows the swear word because of Floyd. Kidding me.
Not kidding, Cash says.
Not kidding. Of course not kidding.
Somehow, Cash weaseled his way onto that boat and into near-daily interaction with Ayers.
"I didn't realize you liked the water," Baker says. "I thought you were more of a mountain guy."
He says this with relative equanimity. What he's thinking is this. You hate water unless it's frozen. You're 10,000 feet out of your comfort zone. The only reason you're here is to try and steal my girl.
How did you find out about the job, anyway?
Ayers texted me, Cash says. He rubs Winnie under the chin.
Winnie and I just went for a hike and a swim with Ayers and Maya on the Johnny Horn Trail. It was beautiful, but man, was it hot. I was dreaming about this pool the whole way back.
Cash pries off his hiking boots and strips down to his board shorts. Baker tries to look at his brother objectively. Cash is in good shape. He has six-pack abs and really strong legs from all the skiing, but he's not quite 6 feet tall, so Baker has always discounted him as a possible rival. But now, Baker has all kinds of troubling thoughts. Maybe Ayers is into the short, stocky, and admittedly super-cut look, as opposed to the tall, broad-shouldered, and, admittedly, dad-bod look. Baker flexes his arm behind him to see if he still has triceps. Maybe. It's hard to tell. Cash went hiking and swimming with Ayers and Maya. He's been the recipient of Ayers' smile. It's Baker's fantasy. He's jealous. His first instinct is to be a jerk about it. But honestly, he doesn't want to do battle with Cash over Ayers. He doesn't want to do battle with Cash over anything. He finds he's actually psyched and relieved that Cash is here. Baker talked a big game about moving down here, but he doesn't know a soul except for Ayers and, sort of, Huck, and he has nothing in the way of a support system. He can continue to day trade, and he can accept Anna's offer of financial help, but he needs to see if life here is sustainable. School for Floyd, some kind of job for himself that's part-time with flexible hours that will get him out of the house and into the community. He could even volunteer.
How's Maya doing? Baker asks. Was she okay seeing you?
Surprisingly, yes, Cash says. She seems great.
I mean, don't get me wrong, she had a moment or two where she almost broke down.
I'm going down the slide, Floyd announces. Uncle Cash, are you getting in?
Cash jumps into the pool and swims over to a spot where he can watch Floyd go down the slide to the lower pool.
But, I mean, generally, she was okay.
She's a smart kid. She was teaching me about the island's history and the plants and trees.
Maybe I'll apply for a job with the National Park Service, Baker says.
Cash gives him an incredulous look, and Baker thinks it's probably justified. Being a park ranger must require years in forestry school or some such.
And before you ask, Ayers is still with Mick. I saw them together at Latapa last night.
He'll cheat on her again. Baker says.
Agreed, Cash says.
He holds Baker's gaze for a second, and Baker can tell they're thinking the same thing. Once Mick cheats on her again, it'll be brother against brother. Or maybe not, Baker thinks. Maybe Cash will realize that he and Ayers should just remain friends. Maybe Cash will fall for one of the young single women who climb aboard Treasure Island.
What's up with Anna? Cash asks.
She and Louisa have accepted positions at the Cleveland Clinic, Baker says. They're moving to Shaker Heights. Floyd will go there holidays and summers. That's why we decided to move down here. There's nothing tethering us to Houston anymore.
Great minds think alike, Cash says. I was going to head to Breck to ski, but it's too late in the season for me to get a decent job. Then Ayers told me about Treasure Island. I start my life-saving classes on Monday.
Baker is surprised that Cash is so organized. It sounds like he's thought something through for once. Objectively, Baker has to admit that Cash would be great as a first mate on a tour boat. When Baker and Anna visited Cash in Breckenridge, they had a chance to see him in action as a group ski instructor, and they had both been impressed. Cash was friendly, engaging, funny, kind, and patient. His patience had been astonishing, in fact.
What would Dad think? Baker asks, if he could see us together right now.
Cash raises his eyebrows.
The more relevant question is, what would Mom think? I talked to her yesterday and she didn't tell me you were coming down. Does she even know?
Baker eases himself into the pool and swims over to Cash. He peers down at Floyd, splashing in the lower pool.
She doesn't.
Why didn't you tell her?
I'm not sure, Baker says. Probably because I didn't want her to stop me.
Legally, it's her house, Cash says. I'm not trying to be a jerk, but my advice is to call her and tell her you're here.
Baker knows Cash is right.
I will, he says. I'll call her tonight after Floyd is asleep.
Before Cash can respond, Baker hears the strains of Blitzkrieg Bop by the Ramones, and Cash pushes himself up out of the pool. He pulls his cell phone out of his shorts, looks at the screen, and says,
Well, guess what? It's Mom.
Good, Baker says. Tell her I'm here.
She'll like it better coming from you anyway.
Cash says, Hello, Mother Alarm Clock, what's up?
Good, yeah.
I saw Maya today.
Ayers and I took her on a hike, or she took us on a hike, actually.
Yeah, I start Monday. They said I'll be good to go in a week.
Hey, listen, I have some news.
Oh, all right. No, you go first.
There's a pause, during which Baker can hear the tinny sound of Irene's voice over the phone, and Baker grows hot and uncomfortable. He just wants Cash to spit it out already. Baker checks on Floyd, who is splashing around, happy as can be, like a model only child. Baker will check out preschools for Floyd. When Baker phoned Anna and told her that he and Floyd were considering moving down to St. John on a somewhat permanent basis, Anna had accepted the news the way she accepted everything he said, with indifference.
It's nice there, Anna said. I'll have to see what Louisa thinks.
It doesn't matter what Louisa thinks, Baker said. She doesn't get to weigh in on my decisions.
But Floyd, Anna says. He recognized her distracted tone of voice. She was probably writing in someone's chart while she was talking to him.
Louisa isn't Floyd's mother, Baker said. You are. Now, assuming I find a suitable school for our child, do you have any objections to Floyd and me spending some time in St. John? The vacation schedule will be the same. Nothing changes except he won't be in Houston. Do you object?
No, Anna said. I guess not.
Wonderful, thank you, Baker said, and he hung up before she could change her mind.
Baker is yanked back into the present moment when he hears Cash say,
A week from Monday?
A week from Monday what? Baker wonders.
Well, you're in for a nice surprise, Cash says, because guess who else is here? Baker and Floyd!
Pause. Baker hears his mother's voice, maybe a little more high-pitched than before.
Yep, I guess Anna took a job in Cleveland, and so Baker and Floyd are... Yep, they're here now.
Yes, Mom, I think that's the plan. Cash locks eyes with Baker and starts nodding.
Yes, it will be so nice. All of us together.
All of us together? Does this mean what Baker thinks it means?
Just text to let us know what ferry you'll be on, Cash says, and one of us will be there to pick you up, a week from Monday.
That night, they grill steaks and asparagus, and Baker makes his potato packets in foil, and he and Cash and Floyd devour everything, and Baker remembers that it's nice cooking for people who actually appreciate it. Floyd goes inside to watch Despicable Me 3 for the 10,000th time, and Baker and Cash stare out at the scattering of lights across the water.
So, Mom is coming a week from Monday, Baker says.
He's not sure how he feels about this.
There are obviously pluses and minuses to this situation.
Agreed, Cash says.
On the plus side, we have been through a family crisis. If Mom stayed in Iowa, I would worry about her.
I can't believe she quit her job, Baker says.
She wants a change, she says.
But working on Huck's fishing boat, Mom?
She's a 57-year-old woman.
She must have been kidding about that.
Don't you remember the way she used to wake us up at dawn on Clark Lake
to go out on Pop's flat-bottom boat to fish for bass? Mom took us, not Dad. Mom baited our hooks. Mom taught us how to cast.
Yeah, I do, Baker says.
He hasn't thought of it in eons, but suddenly he has a vivid picture of being out on Clark Lake before the